This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, Kathleen Heil, president of Arts Center Morro Bay, talks with KCPX's newsroom intern, Myrna Waddell, about the upcoming Art in the Park event.
It's grown so that there's, I believe, 103 vendors that show all original fine arts and crafts.
Then, I speak with Linnea Valdivia, program coordinator at the Gala Pride and Diversity Center.
Something that we really want to do is to show that we are here, we have always been here, and we will, as an organization and as queer individuals, always be a part of this community.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, June 16th, 2025. I'm Mahara Lee. Let's start with donkeys. The Rancho Burro Donkey Sanctuary is a one-of-a-kind nonprofit dedicated to the rehabilitation and care of donkeys on the Central Coast. Today, I'm joined by Carlin Eckford, one of the sanctuary's founders and its medical director, as well as volunteer barn manager Nancy DeRushi. Welcome, Carlin and Nancy.
Thank you.
Let's start by talking about Rancho Burro's history. When was it founded and why? Carlin?
Well, originally, my husband and I had adopted two mammoth donkeys. This was back in 2002, and they were pets. Mm-hmm. And then as you become familiar with donkeys, you also become familiar with what's going on in the equine world. And when we lost our first donkey, we took in a rescue donkey. And then from that point on, every donkey we got was a rescue. And in 2016, we became a 501c3 nonprofit.
Can each of you share your roles and responsibilities at the sanctuary? Nancy, we'll start with you.
I'm a volunteer, and a volunteer is a job that's not paid for. It's not paid for in money. You get a lot of other things back from it. You get the kindness and the love and the bonding of all these animals. But it's a hard job. I mean, it's a physical job. You have cleanup, so you clean up donkey poop, basically, during the course of your day. But you give kindness and caring and, you know, love to these little animals. It's a really big part of the job. Yeah. And we'll give you, for instance, just 2 days ago, we had our big mule. She had colic, and we had to call the vet out a couple of times. And she had a really tough time of it. She had bleeding, and you know, this is just something that's somewhat normal when you treat a horse for colic the way they do it. It's kind of brutal, you know, so to speak. But, you know, you have to go through these things to make them better. And it's hard. It's hard work. You have to care for them and pet them and make sure they stay calm. It's a really big job, and not every volunteer is capable of doing that. So, and then during the course of the day, you help feed, you water, you make sure they're happy. That's really what your job is to give them the kindness that they didn't get, because these were neglected. These were abused animals. And, yeah, a lot of them come scared. And you just have to work with them, be very patient, and win their trust again.
And a follow-up, how did you come to volunteer at Rancho Burro?
My mother. My mother saw, I think she had donated to Rancho Burro along the way. And one Sunday night, it was rather late, she sent me a text message and she says, Nancy, look at this. And of course I did. I applied immediately, and I received a phone call from Laura, our director, and she said, hey, can you come in? We'd like to talk to you. And of course I showed up and we bonded. It was really a nice group of people that I talked to, which would have been Jim and Carlin and Laura, as well as we went out to see the donkeys. And then that's a real hooker. Let me tell you, once you see the donkeys, it's pretty much all over. You fall in love, right? Kind of, you know, love at first sight. And then you realize it's a lot of work. But that's how I came to do it.
So how does Rancho Burro operate? I understand that you're not putting donkeys up for adoption, Carlin.
We are not, because the donkeys that we take in have had some injuries, some abuse, They've been in bad situations. And often when they've come, they're afraid of people because of this. I think they feel very vulnerable and they want to stay away. Let me say that donkeys want to be safe first and foremost. And it's the reason that a lot of people think they're stubborn or find that they can't work with them. They want instant gratification, instant reaction from them, and they're not that way. They're very calm, sweet, and kind animals, but they need to know that they're safe with you. So it's really important that people learn how to care for these animals and what they're all about. So if they want to help them. The reason we don't adopt out is just because of all those very things. After they've gone through the medical rehabilitation that most of them need, and some is ongoing, actually even through 10 years, depending on what it is. After they've gone through all of this and have been in bad situations and we've rehabilitated them, we don't want to then again send them out into a strange environment, because they're all a family once they get there. We're their family, the other donkeys are their family, and I think they'd really be traumatized to be put in another new situation.
Actually, this leads right into my next question. It seems like compared to other animals, donkeys are heavily abused. Why is that? What is the root cause for such a level of mistreatment of donkeys?
Ignorance. Sadly, ignorance. Most people, I think, go into it with the idea that these animals can be just left in a field, left in a backyard, left to fend for themselves. We have had people come in the past to the sanctuary who actually have donkeys, and they'll say, I didn't know they took this much care, you know. And we'll say, well, you do know that they live, what, up to 50 years? And they'll go, what? It's like, yes, a well-taken care of donkey can live into its 50s. And then they go, well, their hooves break off, don't they? And it's like, no, their hooves don't break off. You have to have a farrier come out and take care of hooves. And then they will, you know, they'll talk on, and I'll ask the question, so have you had a veterinarian come out and take care of their teeth? Their teeth continue to grow. So they float their teeth is what it's called. You know, that's what they come out and do. And they actually take a grinder and they grind the tops of the teeth to make sure that they don't grow too high or too sharp. If they have sharp teeth, it tears up the inside of their mouth, which makes it bleed, which means they have abscesses, which means they cannot eat properly or chew properly, so they're not getting the nutrition they need. So when you look at just the basic backyard owner, I mean, that's just one level of neglect, so to speak, that you get. And then there's the ranchers who need to use them for roping. That's a form of neglect, a form of abuse. I mean, there's a lot of different...
Can you share what that is, roping?
Roping, where they will take... typically, they'll use a calf or a small cow, and the calf will be put into a pen, and there's a horse next to it, and they use them at rodeos. And what they will do is they'll open the calf pen. The calf will run off. The horse comes along. The horse will take off next to it, and they take a lasso, and they will rope it. They grab them by the neck, the legs, and they take them down. That's what they practice on. It's abusive. It's terrible. The rodeo industry, I'm sorry. I don't have a lot of respect for the rodeo industry. One of their first rescues was Jojo, had been abused in that way, and the poor little donkey didn't last very long. I mean, Ranchburg gave him a good home. But just from all the abuse of being a roping donkey, a donkey that was drug around basically by a rope, you know, it causes all sorts of different problems. But, I mean, there are different levels of abuse, and that's the sad thing about it. People think they're doing the right thing by throwing them in the backyard, and then when you start talking to them, when you start telling people the kind of care that they need to give to these animals, they're going, man, that costs a lot of money. Yeah, it does. Every time we rescue an animal, it's $3,000 on intake. We rescued three months ago, and we were just looking at photographs of these animals. It's just amazing what we've been able to do in 3 months with proper care. I mean, dental work, x-rays, blood work, and farrier care, and good food. The right food, because they don't eat just alfalfa hay or grass out of the backyard. They have a special diet because if you think about it, they come from the desert, say. So they eat scrubby food. They eat, you know, twiggy food, stuff that's really hard to digest. It's low in sugar. And a lot of times people will feed them the complete opposite of that. So it causes problems.
Anything you'd like to add, Carlin?
I think that when you use the word abuse, a lot of people, that means some physical thing going on, like beating an animal or doing this and that. And neglect is probably the biggest form of abuse that we see. Because even if people start out with donkeys with good intentions, it seems at some point they stop giving them all the care that they need. And they start failing in a lot of ways. You know, they can get just so many issues when they're not taken care of. They're a real animal. They're not like, people think of them as wild, I think. Oh, you know, donkeys are wild. They're fine. You don't have to do anything. But it can't be farther from the truth. They do need care. And they're wonderful, wonderful animals. They're sweet and kind, even after they've been through some of the worst things. Because, as I said before, they want to be safe. And so when you put them in an environment like ours, even if you have to, you know, encourage them to let you touch them or pick up their feet, it doesn't take long. They're really intelligent. And when you start working with them and they realize that they're safe with you, they let you do these things for them. The things I hear most often from people who write to us for information, you know, they're saying, oh, we can't handle this guy. You know, he won't let us do his feet. He goes nuts. I got a cowboy to try to get him. And this can't be farther from the donkey personality than what it is, because that's not going to work for them. Force, abusiveness does not work at all. You know, they love kindness. They're very people-oriented. They love their people. They're very affectionate. They're a lot different than what a lot of people think about them.
If you're just joining us, I'm Meher Ali, speaking with Carlin Eckford, founder of the Rancho Burro Donkey Sanctuary, as well as Nancy DeRushi, who is a volunteer barn manager there.
A very common perception of this is that they're there to be put to work. If that person has taken the donkey and they're going to be using them for work, what is the basic minimum that a person should be doing to take care of a donkey, like a basic minimum?
As we said, they need the proper food, you know, a grass, hay, barley straw. They always need fresh water, and they need the dentals, the hoof care. I think anyone who gets a new donkey, I always recommend that they get blood work on the donkey, because a lot of these donkeys that come from the BLM, for instance, we find they have anemia, and it's not that uncommon in them. And if it's not that, it could be other things. You know, things on a blood test indicate a kidney issue, you know, as example. But you see these things, and then you know how to go forward with what you need to help them with so they can be fully healthy. If you don't do this, you have no idea what's going on inside. If you get a perfectly good blood test, then you have a basis for if something does happen to them. I mean, it's just, it seems like common sense to me, but it is not common sense, apparently.
The other part of that, too, so many people get them for guarding goats or sheep or, you know, that's their job. That isn't their job. One of the problems with that is that donkeys, when they are together with each other, will play. So that means that they will grab each other on the neck and the back. They grab each other's legs. I mean, they play hard. They will do that with a goat, with a sheep, with a chicken. They will pick them up and they will shake them around and they will kill them. So people need to really think twice about, you know, if you're going to get a donkey and give it a job, that's not the job I would give it, you know.
Can I just add that people do legitimately use donkeys to do work on their farms, you know, maybe pull wagons and things like that, and they're okay with that. You just have to know the donkey's weight in relation to what weight you're asking them to pull or carry. You don't want to overload them, because then it becomes abusive. But I think donkeys like to have a little job because they're super smart. And I think they feel good, you know, because we train them to do different things just for fun. But they like to show you the things that they can do. They're fun that way. And I think it's not bad for them to have some sort of a job as long as it's not, you know, abusive to them. Because they're so intelligent. And they're so strong. And I think that's one of the reasons, the strength, is that people feel like they can abuse them because they'll live through a lot. They're very hardy animals. Yeah, I mean, we took in two donkeys that were on 40 acres with absolutely no food for 17 years. And like Nancy said, the woman expected their hooves to break off. And I have a friend who saw them there, and she asked the woman if she would give them to us. And they've never had their feet done or their teeth done in 17 years. And so you can imagine what kind of shape they were in. It was horrible. But they didn't die. They're out there, and I'm sure there's predators coming in. You know, they're strong and smart and have the ability to protect themselves, not in all situations, though.
You shared a lot about donkey behavior, and I really appreciate that because there's so many misconceptions about donkeys. Compared to other animals, how common is it to have a nonprofit dedicated to donkeys, and what are some of the challenges that you face?
Well, I'm not aware of a lot of donkey sanctuaries in this country, which doesn't mean there aren't. But I know of some, and sometimes someone across the country will ask us, you know, about that. We can usually find maybe one. We just got a letter from a girl who has a nonprofit and says on her nonprofit she'll train the donkeys and horses for adoption, yet she wrote to us and said she can't train this donkey at all. She doesn't know how. She doesn't know enough to tell an adoptive person how to take care of this animal. So it becomes, you know, a problem in so many ways. And these animals that people don't want end up getting bought by kill buyers who go around the country and buy animals that are not expensive. And then these kill buyers individually can make $20,000 a year. And then they take them straight down to Mexico where they're slaughtered. And they get paid by the pound to bring these animals in for slaughter. And so this is a huge, huge problem and the reason so many horses and donkeys are going to slaughter month after month after month.
Why are they slaughtered?
Well, our country used to slaughter for, I don't know why,
food.
But mostly we gave up that role because we don't like it and send it to Mexico to do. And it's done in the most horrendous and horrible way that you don't even want to know about. So this is a huge problem in this country that most people have no idea that this is going on at all.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your programs?
As far as the donkeys, our program is first and foremost taking care of whatever health issues they came in with. And there are some things that have been ongoing and will ultimately lead to them dying, no matter what we do. For instance, heavy donkey, many people overfeed their animals or the wrong food, as Nancy said, and they come severely obese. When they're this obese, that fat that's in there starts attacking their organs and can strangle or smother their organs, and they stop working. This can lead to an early death. So we take them in, and having said that about the weight, they have to lose weight over a long period of time, or it's dangerous to them as well. So like a couple of years, 3 years, sometimes it takes, and just changing the routine, more exercise, less food, best of the good food, minerals, things that they need to thrive and that change their whole body composition as well as we can. And then we work a lot with them to make sure they get exercise, make sure that it's something that we watch for every day. Do they feel lame today? Is this going on? Is that going on? Because they've all had these issues in the past, and they resurface. Sometimes they resurface, and you kind of have to start from scratch again with how do we handle these hooves that have been so severely damaged that they take years to come back near to what they're supposed to look like or don't at all. And that's an ongoing care issue.
Do you also provide information like through your website or through community-based programs about awareness of how people should be treating their donkeys?
Interesting you said that. We have just recently moved to a new sanctuary. We have more space, and we have decided that we would like to start having more community programs to educate the public. We are going to be having 15 donkeys coming to us that were all taken from a kill pen. Return to Freedom, which is, I believe, located in Lompoc, has taken these donkeys, and it's not their specialty, so to speak, on rescues, and that would be us. We're going to be taking them, and this, I think, is a really good stepping-off point for us to start bringing the public into this whole conversation about this is what happens to these animals. People don't know what to do with them. They get frustrated because they say they're untrainable. That's not the case. They're very smart animals, and they're very open to kindness. I mean, they come right around. So I'm hoping that this new group of donkeys that we get will open the door to conversations and programs that we can bring the public in and let them see what we're doing. And this program will, I hope, wake people up to the fact that, the donkeys that you see on the side of the road, pay attention. A lot of times those are the animals that end up in the kill pens because they get old or the people just lose interest. And I think we have an opportunity now in front of us, and I hope the public will take interest in what we're doing.
How can people support Rancho Burro? How can they get involved?
We thrive with donations. Our expenses are huge, as you can imagine. Vets, whenever we need them, I can do a lot of medical stuff with the donkeys, but I don't waste a second calling a vet if that's necessary. And we try to have some programs that, with a donation, people get an educational tour. We're not open to the public at all. But we do educational tours, and only 2 a week because we don't want to put all that on the donkeys.
I think most people, by the time they leave, they go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. A lot of times people will come out and meet our donkeys, and they'll find one that they just fall in love with. And they go, oh, we want Bobo. And so then we have a sidekick program that allows you to be able to support Bobo. So when Bobo needs shoes or when Bobo needs, some type of care, there's a little extra money in it to help support Bobo.
And two mules.
We have two mules. Yes, we do.
So people can support you by donating on your website, which is?
RanchoBurroDonkeySanctuary.org.
Also, if I can just jump in there, we also have a car donation program we just started. So if you have some type of vehicle and you want to donate it to Rancho Burro, we have a program now that we can help you with that.
Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Carlin.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
That was Carlin Eckford, founder of Rancho Burro Donkey Sanctuary, and Nancy DeRushi, a volunteer barn manager at the sanctuary, speaking to me about the abuse of donkeys, misconceptions about them, and what people can do to treat them better. This is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Meher Ali. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Up next, KCBX Newsroom intern Myrna Waddle speaks with Kathleen Heil, president of Art Center Morro Bay.
Hello. Art Center Morro Bay is one of the largest contemporary art galleries on the Central Coast and free and open to the public. It is owned by the nonprofit Morro Bay Art Association, but usually the nonprofit just goes by Art Center Morro Bay. I'll be talking to Kathleen about ongoing exhibits as well as Art in the Park, one of the Art Center's longest running outdoor art festivals on the West Coast. Welcome, Kathleen.
Hello. It's nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Can you talk to us about the history of Art Center Morro Bay?
Yes. It started in 1951 by a group of artists in Morro Bay who wanted to show their art and encourage other artists. And they eventually bought the building that we are in now on Main Street at 835 Main Street in Morro Bay. And over the years, we've expanded it from one gallery to two, and we have a workshop now. And we have an amazing community of artists. And anybody can join, and you don't have to join to exhibit your work. So we have 8 exhibits a year. We offer all kinds of workshops, and right now we're offering children's summer arts, all kinds of workshops for children. And, of course, we do the summer arts in the park 3 times in the summer.
One of the current exhibits the center has is titled Illuminations, where their themes of light, dark, and reflections are portrayed. What led to the decision to choose this theme?
We do 8 a year for the members, and they like themes. So the board comes up with these themes, and this was one. We try and keep it relatively general but inspiring, because we have such a mix of artists. We have very, very skilled artists and ones that are just beginning. And they do everything from technical to abstract. So we want to leave it wide open that they can go in a direction that they want for that. There is everything from acrylics to multimedia to pastels to realistic oils to watercolors, just such a plethora of art in there, and it's all different, all interesting to look at. So that is the members' exhibit that is downstairs in the main gallery, and upstairs we have... It's the Central Coast Artists Collective, and they rent the gallery. They've rented the upstairs gallery. The collective consists of 4 different groups of artists that used to belong to SLOMA, the San Luis Obispo Museum Arts, and they finally broke off from that, and they consist of the photographers, the craft makers, the painters group, and the sculptor group. And right now, the photographers and the crafters are showing. And down the road, in a couple of months, the painters group and the sculptors will be showing.
That's really interesting. Mm.
So there's quite a variety in the exhibit right now. The skill levels are amazing.
So a theme like that keeps it open?
Yes, that's our hope. We don't want to discourage anybody from showing their art.
The second exhibit, like we were talking about, features these photography and crafts. And for later, there will then be sculptors and painters. But for this one, can you share some of the pieces that are on display for them and maybe some of your favorites?
Oh, you're going to put me on the spot. I do have to say that the crafts that we have in there are absolutely lovely. We have some tapestry. We have ceramics. We've got some beautiful woodworks. We've got some bronze works. They're just exquisite. And the photography group are very good photographers. They, I believe, are a juried group. So you have top photographers in there and just beautiful, beautiful photos of the area. They're all my favorites. I love that they want to show in the gallery.
The Morro Bay Art Association is celebrating 70 years of art in the park. The next festival is happening the weekend of July 4th. Can you tell us more about that festival and why it got started?
Well, the reason it got started is that the local artists wanted the public to see their art. And they started out by actually hanging their art on trees throughout Morro Bay, and then decided to eventually take over the park and put on exhibits. And it's grown so that there's, like, I believe, 103 vendors that come. It's all original fine arts and crafts that's exhibited there. And it's free to the public. It's a wonderful 3-day weekend, fun in the sun. And the Art Association, we have a tent also that our members can exhibit at free if they do a 2.5-hour stint over the 3-day festival.
Are you guys doing anything special or looking forward to some special plans?
Well, we hope to get banners up, and we are having a big party about it. But we're also, we'll be moving in a new direction for Art in the Park next year for 2026. We will be taking it back to the roots. We want it to become more community involved and more for the artist, the focus on the artist, and pulling the community in. We'd like to pull businesses in. We'd love this to become a community-wide weekend, 3 weekends for the summer. So that's what we'll be working towards.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm Myrna Waddle talking to Kathleen Heil, president of the Art Center Morro Bay. The nonprofit is celebrating 70 years of Art in the Park this year, and the next festival starts on July 4th. There are also 2 exhibits ongoing till June 23rd that feature work from Central Coast artists. How did you personally become involved in the Art Center?
I'm a new one. I ended up moving to the Central Coast about 3.5 years ago, and I had a brother and 2 sister-in-laws here. So I heard about this community, and I looked into it, and I loved it. I have lived many places and have never seen such a thriving art community as I found here. So I went in and said, what can I do? And they said, we need a treasurer. So I said, okay, if that's what you need, I'll do it. And I have met so many fabulous people, and I feel so lucky that I belong to it.
What are some of the challenges of running an arts nonprofit, particularly in this current climate?
I think one of the biggest challenges is that there are so many things we could do and want to do. There's just not enough time to do it all. And it's a matter of getting the people to help do this. We are a nonprofit. And we only have so many people that have time to help. And all these projects take time. So we focus on the most important ones. And right now, the next one will be setting up a new exhibit after the present one. And that happens in June 24th. And that takes about 3 days of sorting out the art, bringing it in, sorting it out, hanging it, and tagging it so that we can open a new show. And we also have the children's show, the children's summer arts going on. And that takes up a lot of the workshop space. And then our energies are focused on getting Art in the Park set up and happening for the 3 days and then taken down and put away. So,
a lot of hands on deck for sure.
Yes, it takes a lot of hands.
Now, how can people in the community or outside of the community support the Art Center?
They can come and pitch in. They can donate. They can talk to their friends. They can come to the gallery, look at the art that's there, purchase the art. All artists love it when their artwork is sold.
Of course. Is there anything that you would like to add about this?
I just would like to say that we are very lucky to have this amazing organization in this area. It's a very special place with some people that are so giving of their time and so interested in seeing that it's successful. And to have those kinds of people around is, it's encouraging, it's inspiring for the new artists, it's supportive for the people who have been doing art for a long time. It's such a community. I'm very lucky to be part of that.
I'd like to bring it back to the 70th anniversary just one more time. You guys said you were bringing it back to the roots. Is there anything more you could share on some ideas?
We have appreciated the organization that's run it for the last 10 years. They've done a good job, but we feel it's time to head in a new direction, and we're excited about that. And next year will also be Art Center's 75th anniversary. So we will be celebrating that also with banners, we hope, and music and an event. We'll be working with the chamber and putting on a big event for that to celebrate. Yes. Any excuse for a party.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I just would like to say that we have 8 exhibits a year, so that means 8 opportunities for people to enter their artwork. It's everything from experienced artists to people that are just beginning in art. We have a big event at the end of the year, the beginning of November, where we have an arts and crafts fair can make things and bring it to be exhibited for Christmas. It's essentially a Christmas fair. I would also like to mention that we have high schools like Tulare High School that come for workshops. And they will bring like 50 students that are in their media, and we put on a workshop with them, and it is so full of energy, and we have so much fun with these students. So, yes, we encourage any high school, if they're interested in coming to, or junior high, coming to have a workshop, we welcome them.
Are the workshops specific to any age groups?
We gear them towards the age groups, yes. Like the summer arts for kids are geared for the 6-year-olds to 12-year-olds. We hope to eventually have after-school art programs because we understand that the middle schools are not going to be offering art anymore. And we feel that we could step in and help in this area by offering workshops.
How can people contact Art Center Morro Bay or look into you guys?
We have a website. It's artcentermorrobay.org. And we also have the gallery. Just come in and see us. We're open from noon every day to 4. And we would love to see you.
Thank you so much. That was Kathleen Heil, president of the Art Center Morro Bay, talking to us about Art in the Park, the longest-running outdoor festival on the coast, celebrating 70 years this year. It starts on July 4th. The Art Center's current exhibits are also on display until June 23rd. One is titled Illuminations, and the other features a photography and crafts exhibition. This is Issues and Ideas, and I'm KCBX newsroom intern Myrna Waddle.
Up next, India and Pakistan engaged in a 4-day military conflict. KCSB's Devin Salva interviewed retired Professor Emeritus of Sociology and Global Studies, Mark Juergensmeyer, to understand the history of relations between the two countries and the global significance of this conflict.
From May 7th to 10th, 2025, the greatest escalation between India and Pakistan in recent decades took place. This escalation began with a terrorist attack in Kashmir, where 26 Hindu tourists were killed in Paglam by the Resistance Front, or TRF. India retaliated by ending various trade agreements, including the Indus Water Treaty, which partitions the Indus Water Basin with Pakistan. After more back and forth, India fired missiles at what they describe as terrorist bases, as well as 4 sites in the Punjab province, according to Al Jazeera. Following this, both sites launched drone strikes at the other, targeting military bases, according to The Time. On May 10th, a ceasefire was brokered by the U.S. Today, I talked to Professor Emeritus Mark Juergensmeyer about India-Pakistan relations.
It all goes back to the creation of Pakistan out of the Indian subcontinent and what is now Bangladesh. And this was the idea at the time that was reinforced by the British, wrongly, I think, but that's a different story, that religious communities really constituted the major divisions among groups within India. So the British said, well, look, you know, we've got all these princely states, and so we'll let them decide whether they want to go with Pakistan or India, and it's really up to them. Kashmir was a special story because you had majority Muslims, but the ruler was a Hindu. So he said, okay, let's go with India. And Pakistan said, the hell with that. They're mostly Muslims. So they moved in on one side. India tried to defend the other side. They went back and forth. So immediately upon the creation of India and Pakistan, there was a war between the new India and the new Pakistan over Kashmir. And they came to a ceasefire, which still exists. So this has been going on for a long, long time. One of the things that happened after the Pahalgam incident was not only India's attack on those bases of the terrorists, but also suspended an agreement for water rights in Pakistan. There are these five rivers that actually start in India and flow into Pakistan and then become the Indus. And without that water supply, Pakistan would just be a desert. You know, it's absolutely essential for everything in Pakistan, certainly agriculture, commercial activities. And so for India to put a block on Punjab's access to that water is very serious stuff. So the first thing that needs to be done now is to repair the issue over the water rights, which is very important. One of the things that has complicated the relationship on both sides is religion. Initially, these were secular states. Well, that's changed on both sides of the aisle. So religion has kind of moved into Pakistan politics, and Hinduism has moved into Indian politics, and it marginalizes people who are not part of the dominant religion.
Thank you for listening. With KCSB News, this is Devin Salva.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, we're celebrating Pride Month in June, and speaking with me about it, as well as challenges facing the LGBTQ community on the Central Coast, is Linnea Valdivia, Program Manager at the nonprofit Gala Pride and Diversity Center, located right here in San Luis Obispo. Gala Center was founded in the 1990s and offers a variety of services, including social support groups, advocacy, resources, and referrals, all designed to help LGBTQ plus individuals thrive. Welcome, Linnea.
Hi, Mayor. Thank you for having me.
What is the story behind the founding of the Gala Pride and Diversity Center?
Yeah, it just started with a group of folks that were meeting and doing kind of these informal support groups with one another. And there were two organizations that were meeting up in Los Osos, a Business Leaders Association and an explicitly LGBTQ support group. And the two merged to form Gala in 1997.
Okay. What were the kind of conversations that happened that led to people saying, okay, like, we need a nonprofit that specifically focuses on LGBTQ rights?
It's funny that you're asking that. We're going through a lot of our archives right now to answer some of these questions. A lot of the folks that were, you know, involved in the beginning of Gala have moved on, and so we are, you know, going through our records to try and find those very answers. One of the ways that we're trying to engage history and engage folks right now is that as part of our Pride celebration this year, we had an exhibit at the History Museum of San Luis Obispo, which was supported by the History Center, obviously, the San Luis Obispo Museum of Art, and a generous grant from the Community Foundation, the Growing Together Fund, and the Slow Queer Archive. There's a lot of people that had their hands in this project, but we created an exhibit of past prides in San Luis Obispo.
Wow.
So the year after that we were founded was the year that we had our first pride. And so we have all of these wonderful pictures of Pride in the Plaza from 1997, like this really vibrant community that goes back almost 30 years. And so something that we really want to do at the Gala Center for Pride, but, you know, year round, is to show that we are here. We have always been here, and we will, as an organization and as queer individuals, we are always going to be a part of this community.
I didn't see that exhibit. When was it?
So it actually opened as part of our Pride in the Plaza celebration on May 31st, and the History Museum reported that they had record-breaking attendance to that exhibit, which was really exciting. And they generously ended up leaving up our exhibit, and it's going to be up through the end of June into early July. So folks have a lot of time to go support the History Center and see great work that we're doing.
And can you share the title once again for that exhibit?
Yeah, it's called Then, Now, Forever, which is also the theme of Pride this year.
So one of the things that caught my attention when I was reading your bio on Gala's website was that you're collaborating with the community to, quote, build sustainable community-serving programs. Can you talk more about that, as well as your personal journey of coming to work at the Gala Center?
One of my priorities as the program manager is to conduct an audit of the services that we're providing the community and see what need there is, because support groups are very important. They're bread and butter. That is how Gala started. That is how our partner organization, Trans Central Coast, started, is by these living room support group meetings that are so important to so many queer people. But we also want to make sure that we are providing ongoing programming that meets the needs of our community. My three planks in my plan are: I want to expand programming that increases access to healthcare resources, that empowers people to remain civically engaged, and increase engagement with art, because that is a big part of our history as an organization. Gala did a lot of art programming, and the building was set up to be partially a gallery space. And art is a really powerful tool for community building, for reducing isolation and loneliness, which we know is a problem, not only in SLO, but in the country at large.
So a follow-up question that I had was, could you expand on what are the specific challenges that queer people face when they're accessing healthcare?
Yeah, I was just at a panel hosted by Assemblymember Don Addis, and there was a doctor on the panel who was saying, like, I know how to navigate the system. I've been a healthcare practitioner for 40 years, and it took me months and months to find a primary care physician that would see me and take my insurance. So even for people who know how to navigate the system, it is extremely difficult to find healthcare. If you layer on top of that somebody who's queer or trans, there are very specific needs for those groups of people. There's a cultural competency around, like, what even being queer or trans means, what somebody needs in order to access gender-affirming care. I've known people who go to a therapist in the county who say that they would need to be in therapy for 3 years before they would provide them a letter supporting their transition, which is not medically true. And so there's, like, a lot of providers in this county that just don't understand the processes of gender-affirming care. And we're very lucky to have places like Planned Parenthood, who have been historically very supportive of the queer and trans community. But of course, the political moment that we're in is putting that in jeopardy in a really major way. And so in my work at Gala, I'm really trying to expand partnerships and programs that will make that easier to access, or make it so folks can access them at all.
Another follow-up question. I wanted to invite you to break down some of the things that you talked about. You spoke especially about two things that I'm interested in. One is, you use the phrase cultural competency, and the other is gender-affirming care. Could you perhaps expand on what each of these mean or look like on, like, a day-to-day basis?
When I talk about cultural competency when it comes to providing health care to queer and trans folks, I think, you know, primarily that means understanding the medical and cultural needs of those that are LGBTQ. And that can mean, you know, not assuming somebody's sexual orientation if you see somebody who's visibly queer, not assuming that, oh, this person in front of me, I am reading as a queer or a gay woman, so I don't need to ask about birth control, or I don't need to ask about family planning or something like that. And when I talk about gender-affirming care for queer, trans, and gender non-conforming people, I am talking about gender-affirming hormone therapy. So if somebody is seeking estrogen or testosterone, like, providers needing to know the parameters to prescribe those things, which, you know, some providers just don't. And then I'm also talking operationally about, am I going to be called the wrong name when I enter the hospital? Or am I going to be called the wrong name when I go to my doctor's office? If I'm admitted to the emergency room, is my bracelet going to identify me as the wrong sex? Like, there are operational and interpersonal barriers to care. There's this concept called trans broken arm syndrome, mm-hmm. where if somebody is going into the doctor and saying, like, I have a broken arm or like I have an ear infection, there are some providers that will make the issue everything having to do with your gender identity, or could it be the hormones or something like that? And it's just like, oh, no, I just need an antibiotic. So there are kind of two sides of this coin of like making sure that folks feel recognized and seen in their identities when they're accessing care, and also to know that when they walk into a doctor's office, not everything is going to be made about their gender identity or sexual orientation.
Which it often is.
It often is, yes.
If you're just joining us, I'm Meher Ali speaking with Linnea Valdivia, Program Manager at the nonprofit Gala Pride and Diversity Center. How have Donald Trump's current policies and anti-trans and anti-queer propaganda affected the LGBTQ community at the local level in San Luis Obispo County?
There are some that are pretty severe, like the executive order saying that there's only two sexes, that everybody is the sex assigned at conception, which would make everybody female, but, you know, whatever. But then I think a lot of that rhetoric, a lot of that scapegoating that's happening at the federal level is empowering folks locally in our community to discriminate or otherwise trying to marginalize or erase queer folks from everyday life. We see this at school board meetings that are happening in South County, trying to ban trans kids from sports. We see this up in Morro Bay with the rescinding of the flag ordinance to fly the pride flag.
Could you actually expand on some of those things that you just mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So just weeks before Pride Month, so in May last month, the Morro Bay City Council voted to rescind a flag policy that was passed in 2022. And that there were two ordinances that were passed in 2022, same day. The first one was an ordinance saying we, the Council of Morro Bay, are allowing commemorative flags to be flown. So if the City Council of Morro Bay votes to fly a commemorative flag, we can do that. The second was an ordinance explicitly naming LGBTQ citizens as valued members of the community, and that the pride flag should be flown every June. And that has happened, as far as I know, without comment, without controversy, since 2022. And I should note that the pride flag is the only commemorative flag that was flown under this ordinance. And last month, without, I would say, adequate reason, the city council voted to rescind both ordinances. And after some really intense pushback from the community, they pushed back this repeal until July 1st, which effectively allows the pride flag to go up this year, be quietly taken down, and not flown again.
Ever?
Ever. Unless the city council votes to allow commemorative flags to be flown again, but it is needless erasure. The closest thing that I heard to a reason is that council member Jeff Eccles, who kind of led this repeal, said that the council could potentially vote to fly the Nazi flag, which sort of shuts down any dialogue about that.
That's a very shocking statement.
It's an incredibly shocking statement. And, you know, shuts down dialogue and just tells me, as a community member, that he and the rest of the council members who voted unanimously to repeal the flag ordinance, that they're not interested in a dialogue about this, that they're not interested in robustly recognizing the LGBTQ community, which is an important part of our community.
It's Pride Month. What has the Gala Center been doing to celebrate, and can you share details about some upcoming events?
We have had a lot going on so far this Pride Month. So we started off our extended Pride Fest celebrating May through June this year because we had so much going on. Our kind of first main event was Pride in the Plaza on May 31st. And that is a celebration that we've had for nearly 30 years now. It's our 28th year this year. And so we had a massive turnout. We had thousands of people. We had an opening ceremony featuring the Slo County Poet Laureate, Caleb Nichols. We had speakers and drag queens. It was an amazing, amazing day. And then our second big event was Trans Pride in the Park. And that was in Meadow Park. It was on June 1st. It was like our first official Pride Month event. And it was just a beautiful event. We had gender-affirming haircuts. We had a nail salon. We had legal counsel there to talk to folks about name changes and other kind of, you know, legal logistical things. We had performances from PCPA and other dance company. It was just a beautiful celebration. That's kind of our big celebration weekend and went really well this year. And then throughout the rest of the month, and folks can go to our Instagram or our website, which is galacc.org, G-A-L-A-C-C.org, to learn more about our events coming up.
Can you share a story with us of success or resilience that perhaps underscores the importance of the Gala Center and why it needs to exist?
Well, as folks may be aware, the Gala Center is going through a period of pretty profound transformation. We've had a full turnover in our staff. I am the new and only full-time staff right now. We had a very public breakdown in our trust with a lot of our community partners and the people that we serve because of our last executive director and the manner in which he left. But even through that, we have been working really hard to rebuild those relationships, and we've seen an outpouring of support from our community, I think even despite that, which speaks to me to the deep need that this community has for a space that is supportive of queer people. And so many others. Like, we are the Gala Pride and Diversity Center, and we believe very strongly in coalition building between queer folks and folks with disabilities and people of color. And we right now are trying really hard to rebuild those relationships and be better community partners. And it's been really amazing to see so much support from the community, from other nonprofits, from other businesses that really recognize the need for an organization like ours in the St. Louis Obispo community.
How can people support the Gala Center?
The best way to support us is to get involved. The volunteer opportunities run the gamut from tabling at farmers to running a support group to digitizing our archives, grant writing. There's something for everybody to do to get involved.
And your website is, again?
galacc.org. Our Instagram is at the Gala Center.
And people can also donate on your website, correct?
Oh, absolutely. People can also donate. We're always looking for donations, but like whether that's money or time or something in kind, like we just want folks to engage with us.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
That was Linnea Valdivia, Program Manager at the nonprofit, the Gala Pride and Diversity Center, speaking to me, Meher Ali, about their work, the challenges facing the nonprofit under the current administration, as well as events for Pride Month. To support the Gala Center, visit their website, galacc.org.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. Follow us on Instagram at KCBXFM. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.